Well, first of all, I'd just like to begin by also acknowledging the traditional custodian of the lands on which we meet today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and I extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people joining us today. It's a real privilege to be here again. This is my third time doing this as Governor. It's almost always the most nerve-wracking speech I do because I have former governors sitting in the audience listening to me. But Michelle's words were really powerful. The reason I wanted to be involved with Annika and continue to be involved in this foundation is because of its focus on youth mental health. It does make a difference. As Michelle said, it is making a difference in the lives of young Australians and their families. Although many of us may not have experienced the horrors of suicide and youth suicide, I am 100% certain that most of us have been touched by mental health issues in youngsters, and so I think it's really important that you're all here today to support it. So thank you for that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the economy and a little bit about supply shocks and where we might be headed, although that's very difficult to say, I have to say. So a defining feature and recurring feature of the global economy in recent years has been the increasing frequency and the impact of supply shocks. So first of all, there was this shock associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. Then there was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that led to a big energy price spike. And then as some of those disruptions associated with those things, they began to reduce, new risks have emerged. The conflict in the Middle East obviously is disrupting energy markets. There's severe weather events affecting production and trade around the world. And there's, of course, continuing trade tension, and that's adding further ambiguity. So the outlook can change very quickly and uncertainty can re-emerge even as earlier risks begin to ease. So today I'm going to discuss how recent global developments are affecting Australia, and I'm going to place them in historical context by looking back to the oil shocks of the 70s. The world has been more shock prone in recent years, but the economy is more resilient than it was in the past. The adoption of credible inflation targets by central banks to keep inflation low and stable has played a role in that improved resilience. But this doesn't mean we're immune from adverse supply shocks. They can constrain growth, reduce real incomes, and add to inflationary pressures. In this environment, our job as central bankers is to keep inflation expectations anchored and make sure that shocks don't lead to lasting increases in inflation. With inflation and capacity pressures already elevated, recent shocks have added further to the inflation impulse. That's why we tightened monetary policy earlier this year and why we remain focused on returning inflation sustainably to target. Now, before turning to current conditions, I wanted to reflect on the inflation challenge we've faced in recent years. So following a once-in-a-century pandemic, economies all around the world experienced inflation outcomes that I think few current central bankers had encountered in their professional lives. And Australia was no different here. We had demand and employment outcomes remaining strong, but we had too high inflation. And our challenge was to bring inflation down while preserving as many of the gains in the labour market as possible. And I'm sure many of you have heard me say that before. In Australia, inflation declined significantly from its peak, and the underlying inflation also moderated in 24 and 25. Our forecasts at the time suggested inflation would return sustainably to target over time, and this marked important progress in restoring price stability after a period of global disruption. But inflation, as we know, has since increased and it's now above target. Indeed, it was rising and above target even before the recent oil price rises. So this means we haven't yet achieved our objective of returning inflation sustainably to target. Now, higher inflation isn't just a statistic. It strains household budgets, it complicates business planning, and it weighs on confidence. And many Australians are again feeling this pressure. We recently published survey evidence showing that inflation is the single most pressing economic concern for Australians. And the Monetary Policy Board is acutely aware of the impact of this high inflation. So let me turn now to how we're assessing the impact of this year's conflict in the Middle East and a little bit of evidence on how the Australian economy is so far responding to the recent increases in the cash rate. So 5 months have passed since the conflict began, and while there are now some signs of the impact of the conflict on inflation and activity, recent developments in commodity markets are a reminder that conditions can change quickly and that it remains too early to assess the full economic impact. In this environment, the outlook remains uncertain. Ongoing commodity price volatility seems likely, which makes it even more difficult to assess the ultimate effect on inflation and activity. And likewise, monetary policy operates with a lag, so the full effects of this year's cash rate increases are yet to be felt. Since the outbreak of the conflict, oil prices have been highly volatile, and as recent days and weeks have demonstrated, conditions can change quickly. While the effect on fuel prices and headline inflation has so far been smaller than initially feared, headline inflation has remained well above at the target at 4% in May. More importantly, underlying inflation, which is a better guide to the inflation impulse that abstracts from volatile prices, it's evolved broadly as we expected back in May, but it's still too high. Elevated inflation is consistent with ongoing capacity pressures in the domestic economy, which had re-emerged before the conflict in the Middle East. It also reflects some pass-through of earlier fuel costs, higher fuel costs to other prices. For instance, new dwelling inflation picked up noticeably in the May CPI data, partly reflecting higher fuel and construction costs. We're also hearing from our business and community liaison program that non-labour cost pressures have continued to pick up and more firms are looking to pass these costs on. Demand growth appears to be moderating broadly as expected in our May baseline forecasts, and that's helping to bring aggregate demand closer into line with the economy's supply potential. So far, there's limited evidence of a large effect of the spike in oil prices on household spending, and that in part reflects temporary policy measures such as the reduction in fuel excise. Consumer sentiment remains very weak, though it has recovered somewhat from its trough in April. But while households remain cautious, spending has been more resilient than sentiment alone might suggest. Timely indicators, including liaison, point to moderate growth in consumption over the June quarter, broadly as we'd expected. And household savings rates also appear to be relatively stable. Business confidence fell sharply at the start of the conflict, but it's rebounded somewhat over recent months. And the decline in business conditions and capacity utilisation has been less pronounced. Business investment has been stronger than expected, largely driven by investment in data centres. One sector of the economy that's been weaker than expected is the housing market. Now, we had expected conditions to ease in response to the changed outlook for monetary policy and the rise in the cash rate earlier this year. But the housing market has eased by more than we had anticipated in May. This appears to reflect a range of factors, including recent policy developments affecting the housing market and a general softening in housing market sentiment. Even so, the easing in established housing prices so far has been modest, following a period of strong growth. Price declines have been concentrated in the Sydney and Melbourne markets, but prices in these markets remain around where they were before interest rates started to rise in February this year. Furthermore, the recent data suggests that notwithstanding the price falls, negative equity remains very limited, affecting less than 1% of borrowers. Of that small group, our estimates suggest that only a small share of borrowers are facing severe difficulty with their loan repayments. Now, this is not to downplay that this would be very stressful for those people that are affected, but it does indicate that financial stability risks are contained and borrowers in aggregate have built up considerable savings buffers over the years. While we expect housing prices to be affected when interest rates rise, monetary policy doesn't target housing prices. Rather, what matters for monetary policy is how changes in housing prices affect household spending, investment decisions, and ultimately inflation. The labour market has also eased a bit more than expected over recent months, moving it a little closer to balance relative to its tight starting point. The unemployment rate has risen by somewhat more than expected, but other indicators, such as job advertisements, have remained more resilient. Recent intelligence from our liaison programs suggests that some firms paused hiring in the early stages of the conflict, but some hiring activity seems to have resumed more recently. Overall, we continue to assess that some further easing in labour market conditions will likely be required to bring inflation back to target. As we prepare updated forecasts for August, we're considering how key judgments and assumptions underpinning the May forecasts have evolved. We're assessing how recent developments, including higher input costs and geopolitical tensions, will affect inflation. Domestic demand has eased broadly as expected, and labour market conditions have softened somewhat. But with continued weak productivity growth, the economy simply can't grow strongly without putting pressure on inflation. And this is a fundamental challenge for the Australian economy over the next few years. So to understand current circumstances better, it's useful to step back and consider how the supply side of the global economy has evolved over time. This year's oil supply shock has been challenging for households, businesses and the economy. But as I noted in my opening remarks, it's best understood as the latest in a series of adverse supply shocks affecting the global economy, beginning with the pandemic. These shocks have taken a wide range of forms and at times have interacted in compounding ways, amplifying their effects on inflation and economic activity. Global supply chains, particularly through the pandemic, underscored just how interconnected and finely balanced the global economy has become. But despite the scale of the disruption, supply chains in many cases adapted more quickly than initially expected. In earlier decades, the macroeconomic environment was shaped by a more benign supply side. During the period often referred to as the Great Moderation, from the late 1980s through to the global financial crisis, fluctuations in output and inflation were much less pronounced relative to today and to the more turbulent period that preceded it in the 1970s and early 1980s. There were still shocks in that period, but they were predominantly cyclical demand shocks that monetary policy was better equipped to deal with. In part, this stability, compared with the 1970s and 1980s, reflected stronger policy frameworks and structural reforms that were put in place in response to earlier economic volatility. Examples included the adoption of more flexible exchange rates, labour market reforms, and the introduction of inflation targets for central banks. But there was probably also an element of good fortune. There were fewer severe adverse commodity price and productivity shocks during that period, and the emergence of the Chinese economy represented a large favourable supply shock for the rest of the world. So in that environment, monetary policy could focus primarily on managing demand, which in turn meant that the RBA's objectives of price stability and full employment were often complementary rather than in tension. Now that's changed. The pandemic and a series of major global developments since then have delivered a succession of adverse supply shocks. And collectively, these adverse shocks have constrained global growth and contributed to higher inflation at the same time. For Australian households and businesses, adverse supply shocks that originate overseas represent a real income loss. Prices increase, but incomes don't adjust proportionately, which means people can't buy as much as they could before, and many households are worse off. In Australia, these shocks have occurred against a backdrop of persistently weak productivity growth, which has weighed on real incomes and wages for many years. And reversing that is central to improving Australia's living standards over the longer term. Business investment is critical for boosting productivity growth and the economy's supply capacity over time. One element of this watching closely, obviously, is investment in new technologies, including artificial intelligence. But I have to say that there's still considerable uncertainty about the size and timing of the impacts of artificial intelligence on productivity. For monetary policymakers, the implications are significant. When the growth of potential supply is constrained, inflation is higher for any given level of demand, sharpening the trade-off between our dual objectives of price stability and full employment. In a more uncertain and shock-prone world, navigating those trade-offs has become more challenging for central banks. Structural changes in the global economy, alongside stronger institutional frameworks, have made the economy much more resilient to supply shocks than in the 1970s. Being resilient, more resilient, doesn't mean that supply shocks are costless. It means the economy is better able to absorb and adjust to them. This isn't working. There we go. The oil price shocks of 1973 and 1979 provide a clear point of comparison. They were highly disruptive for the global economy, including Australia, with oil prices rising 2 to 3-fold in each episode. And it wasn't just the initial price hikes that made this period so difficult, it was also what followed. In Australia and many other advanced economies, higher costs spread through the economy. Businesses passed rising input costs into prices, while workers sought to protect their purchasing power by demanding higher wages and increasing costs for firms. Over time, inflation became more broadly based and persistent. Policy responses initially sought to support activity in the face of the shock, but over time, higher inflation expectations became embedded in the decision-making of households and firms, making the problem self-perpetuating and much harder to resolve. Putting off a period of tight monetary policy today can mean higher interest rates and higher unemployment down the track. Bringing inflation and inflation expectations down ultimately required a significant tightening in monetary policy. That came at the cost of severe recessions and high unemployment in many advanced economies. The further inflation moves from target, the more embedded it becomes, the harder it is to reverse. Credibility is hard won and it's easily lost. In Australia, inflation peaked at 12.5% in 1982. While it had declined to around 2.5% by the end of 1984, this came at the cost of a sharp rise in unemployment. It rose from about 6% at the turn of the decade to a peak of 10.5% in 1983. The Australian and the global economies today are very different from those of the 1970s. This helps to explain why the recent oil price shock has had a more limited impact on activity. First, the economy is less dependent on oil. This means a given increase in oil prices has a less direct and less pervasive effect on inflation today than it would have had in the 1970s. The second point is that monetary policy frameworks have evolved considerably, partly reflecting the lessons of the 1970s and 1980s. The widespread adoption of clear and credible central bank inflation targets has helped anchor the expectations of households and businesses, reducing the risk that temporary supply shocks translate into more persistent inflation. And third, economies are more dynamic and interconnected. So while this can transmit shocks more quickly, it also increases the ability of firms and supply chains to adapt. While higher energy prices still place real strain on households and businesses, recent experience since the pandemic suggests that individual supply shocks are less likely on their own to trigger the kind of prolonged high inflation and high unemployment seen in the past. However, the outlook becomes more complex when multiple shocks occur in quick succession and they interact. The greater frequency and diversity of supply shocks in recent years have demonstrated the value of these shock absorbers, including flexible exchange rates and more credible monetary policy frameworks, deeper financial markets and more competitive product markets, as well as more adaptable labour markets. For central banks, this reinforces the importance of conducting policy in a way that maintains public confidence that inflation will remain under control. So let me conclude with some reflections on the implications for monetary policy. The global environment has changed and the outlook is uncertain. While this makes the task of monetary policy more complex, our objectives haven't changed. The board remains focused on delivering price stability and full employment. The full effects of the increases in the cash rate from earlier this year will take time to materialise. And even if the renewed disruption to oil supply abates quickly, underlying inflation is still expected to be higher as fuel price rises flow through to other prices. It's also important to remember that inflation and capacity pressures in the domestic economy were already too high prior to the recent shock. There's evidence that domestic demand and labour market conditions have been easing as required to bring the economy back towards balance. Against a backdrop of ongoing capacity pressures, the board remains focused on preventing elevated cost pressures from entrenching inflation. This does mean that some further easing in the growth of demand is likely to be required if we're to bring inflation back down sustainably to target. A key question in the period ahead is whether the tightening in monetary policy earlier in the year is sufficient to achieve this. While conditions vary across sectors, the economy overall has adjusted gradually and broadly as expected. One thing monetary policy can't do, however, is address the economy's slow productivity growth. While this persists, the ability of the economy to grow without generating inflation is constrained, and Australians will continue to experience limited growth in real wages. In these circumstances, the best contribution monetary policy can make is to maintain low and stable inflation and support sustainable full employment. The board is prepared to act as required to achieve its mandate, including by increasing the cash rate further if needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. As you're typing away what some of those key insights were, don't forget the QR code. Now we're going to take questions. So just a reminder, that's the media mic and that's the non-media mic, and to keep your questions very short so we can get through as many as possible. I'm going to go to the first speaker at the non-mic.
Hi, I'm George Tharanu, UBS Chief Economist for Australia and New Zealand. Governor Bullock, thank you very much for your speech. Let's go back to May. The RBA's forecast for inflation was pushed up, headline 4.8, and you were thinking the trim end could be around the 4% mark, maybe a little bit lower. As you suggested, the monthly data is basically being in line at the trim level, but the headline's going to come in a lot lower. So the market has moved away from an August rate hike, and the consensus on the buy side and sell side thinks you don't move again. However, my forecast is still that the trim mean in the next print tomorrow on a quarterly run rate is about 0.9 or 1 and a quarter, about 3.8 in the year, which is broadly in line with your forecast. And I think the RBA still hikes at its next meeting in August. Would you agree with my assessment that the RBA's next meeting is live?
You're very entitled to your opinion, George. what you've highlighted really is that inflation is still too high. But we are seeing the economy slow, we are seeing consumption slow, and we have seen the housing market slow more than we were expecting at the time of our May forecast. So it will be interesting to see. There is going to be some flow-on effects, so you are going to see some impact on underlying inflation. There's going to be no doubt about that, and we can't do anything about that. That's going to be cost increases flowing through. The question is what happens after that. Do they continue to increase? Is underlying inflation continuing, or does it start to come off? And so the information tomorrow will be part of that that we'll be looking at. But I think it's also, in terms of what we've seen in terms of the economy, it's pretty much in line with where we thought it was going to be in the May forecast. So we'll wait and see tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time, Michelle. With last year's rate cuts receiving some criticism for prioritising full employment, I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the arguments that unemployment should be considered a microeconomic concern and be left to supply-side reform to sustainably reduce the NAIRU, meaning that RBA could focus solely on inflation, which would allow for the more effective management given the dual mandate forces the RBA to deal with two inversely related objectives with one policy instrument?
So, thanks. Great question. As usual, the most difficult ones come from the students. controlling inflation and keeping unemployment sort of at a sustainably low level aren't necessarily inconsistent with one another. And in fact, I would argue that if you want sustainably good growth in employment and low unemployment rate, you need low and stable inflation, because that's the circumstances in which businesses and households can get about their business without worrying about inflation all the time. Our mandate does have employment in it, as you pointed out, but it's sustainable full employment. So it recognises that we can't do anything necessarily about the sort of structural part of the unemployment, if there's skills mismatches and those sorts of things. That's for other policies to deal with. But I think it's fair to ask us to take into account what we're doing to the employment market while we're bringing inflation down. I think that's a fair way to think about the way we should conduct policy, and the reason I think that is because, yes, ultimately we've really got to make sure we control inflation. But if we can do that in a way that preserves employment, I think that's really valuable to the people who are employed. So I think there is a good part of having that part of our mandate, but I agree that if push comes to shove and we really need to get inflation down, that's where we have to concentrate.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Governor, for the speech. Jonathan Kearns from Challenger. Kevin Walsh, the new Fed chair, seems to be less of a fan of transparency and looking to make changes there. The Reserve Bank's obviously had a lot of changes in recent years. You give press conferences, but you give fewer speeches like this. There's more detail in forecasts, but you studiously avoid giving forward guidance. What would you like to change about transparency at the RBA?
I'd probably rather not have press conferences, but there's probably nothing I'd change about the transparency. I accept that I think there is a need for the central bank as an independent body to be explaining itself and be explaining itself in terms that people can understand. I think one of the things that we have done in terms of transparency at the bank in recent years, it started before I was governor, but is to try and recognise that we are talking to different sorts of people. We're talking from everyone from analysts to traders to the media to our parents. So I think there is a need for us to be transparent. I think generally the reforms we have done have been good in that respect. I think Kevin Walsh is, I don't know him, but my understanding, at least at the moment, is that he doesn't want to be drawn into forward guidance, and I entirely agree with that.
You can understand why. Tapas, and then we'll go to a media question.
Good afternoon, Governor, and it's been a pleasure sitting in the audience of this for the past 3 years and hearing your discussion about inflation and the fiscal side. What really caught my eye in today's speech was your remark towards the end, saying some further easing in the growth of demand was needed. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about that. And on the other side of that, do you think the fiscal authority is also of that view? Because one way you could reconcile the inflation we've seen is the fiscal side operating almost as a counter to some of the monetary tightening that we've seen to date. Thank
okay.
you.
So you've probably asked the question the press were going to ask, I suspect. So the only thing I'm pointing out there is that as growth is slowing, there's a lot of commentary about, oh no, growth is slowing. But we assess at the moment that we have demand in excess of supply. So the growth of demand has to slow in order to bring it down so it's not growing more quickly than supply is growing and generating that inflationary pressure. So the point I guess I was trying to get people to take away was that this is part of the plan. This is what interest rates are designed to do. They're designed to slow demand so that it's more in line with growth in supply, and we alleviate those pressures. Now, Can you do that in different ways? Interest rates is one way of doing it. Another way is to, as you say, is to decrease aggregate demand, growth in aggregate demand, by using fiscal policy. As I've said in many occasions in the past, those are matters for the government. They have to make decisions. They are elected by the Australian people, and they have to make decisions on what they are going to spend money on and how much money to spend it on. So I refrain from offering advice on that, but mechanically you're right. It's part of aggregate demand, and that's another way to bring aggregate demand. But what do you spend less on? That's for governments.
Thank you.
Hi, Governor Stella from Reuters. At the last meeting, you said the board felt it has space to watch what's happening with the Middle East conflict. Is that space still there, or is it running out, especially given the rise in oil prices?
Okay, so similar question to George. What am I going to do with interest rates? When I said I had space, you'll recall at the time we had increased interest rates three meetings in a row, February, March and May. That was 75 basis points. We took back all the easing from the previous year. And we felt that there was an opportunity then, having done that, to see whether or not the conflict was going to continue. I'd have to say it's still pretty uncertain. And if you look at some of our scenarios in the May SMP, you'll see that in the adverse scenario where oil prices sort of go up really high and stay up quite high, that not only has a big impact on inflation, it also has a big impact on growth. So I don't know what the board is going to decide at its next meeting, but I do know that they will be focused. Obviously, tomorrow's information will be important for us in thinking about those inflationary pressures. We're redoing our forecasts, and our baseline forecast will be important there as well. And what it's going to come down to is whether or not the board thinks that interest rates have are at a level that they're restrictive and that they are going to bring inflation down sustainably within a reasonable time period. That still will remain the decision the board's making. But if it looks like that inflation is not coming down, then I think the board have some difficult decisions to make in terms of raising interest rates.
Thank you very much for the speech. Paul Bloxham from HSBC. So in the context of what you just said about a reasonable time period, and also referencing back to the speech you just gave, the TRIM mean has now been above the midpoint of your target band for a little over 4 years. Does it make any difference to the central bank, to the Reserve Bank Board's reaction function, that you've already been above target now for 4 years and you're forecasting you won't get back for another two? Or can we think of it as bygones be bygones, you're a forward-looking inflation targeting central bank, you don't worry about price level targeting? Does it make any difference to the reaction function that you've already been above target for the past 4 years?
Well, I think technically we might have come back into target at least for one or two quarters, but we've
to
been...
To the midpoint. So, the TRIM mean hasn't been at the midpoint.
It hasn't been at the midpoint, but it has come back under three. So I think it's a cautionary tale for the board. As I said, though, and I've said before, things changed in the back half of last year and the board responded, and they demonstrated that they were prepared to respond. And I would say quite firmly. I would agree with you that the longer it is out of target, the more concerned that the board becomes. And I think it is quite at the front of their minds that at the moment, in the May forecast, I think we had it coming back under three sort of towards the end of 27. And that's a long time to be above target. So, yes, I think it is focusing the board's mind, and I also think that let's just hope there's no more shocks. I think the challenge is that if we end up with more coming on the oil price side of things, then I personally worry that this starts to get ingrained, and this is this issue about, we always talk about long-term inflation expectations being anchored. They are. But short-term expectations matter as well. So I think there is a real, the point you raise, I think, is a very important one, and I think that is something that the board is concerned about.
Governor, Ross Greenwood from News 24, formerly Sky News. I just want to follow on with Paul's question. That is, if you'd go to the past decade, so if we go there, 120 months, you've barely been in the underlying inflation rate in that target band for barely 9 months over that period of time, maybe 12, but not very much time at all. Does that imply that there have been errors made in forecasting, errors made in monetary policy, or indeed that the target band itself is wrong and not fit for purpose for Australia?
So let me go to the first one. I think the target band is fit for purpose. And I think if you recall back prior to COVID, we had the opposite problem. We were consistently below target. What does it imply? I think it just demonstrates that forecasting, we have to do it, but it's inherently uncertain. We do the best we can because we can't just look in the rear vision mirror and look at the data and that tells us where we're starting from, but we still need to be forward looking. Do we get forecasts wrong? Yes, we do. Everyone does. But we still have to do them and we still have to make the best decisions we can make based on those forecasts. So, I'd like to be able to say that our forecast, we're really, really confident in our forecast. Further out we go, the harder it gets. The best I think we can do is be responsive and adaptive as things change. And I think we demonstrated that earlier this year when things moved differently than we thought they were going to do and we responded.
Thank you. Over to Phil, who's been very patient.
Governor, thank you so much for your remarks today. Phil O'Donoghue from Deutsche Bank. And as much as I want to ask you about what comes next, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to ask you what has already happened. Why has Australia's inflation trajectory for the last 12 months been so different from our peers? Go back to February this year, you hiked rates, market was still pricing cuts from the Fed Reserve. Why have we been so different?
I think we've been different because we didn't end up with a negative output gap. If you look at some of the countries that we sometimes compare ourselves, our peers in Canada and New Zealand in particular, they increased interest rates more than we did, but they've also got negative output gaps and much higher unemployment rates than we have. We tried consciously with a strategy to bring inflation down, but without raising the unemployment rate too quickly and too sharply. So I think that's why we look different and we're coming from a different position than other countries. They're coming from that negative and we're coming from a positive demand gap. So that would be my reason.
Thank you.
Michael Yander from ABC News. Your survey shows inflation is the biggest concern for most Australians, but it also shows most of those Australians think you're contributing to it by raising interest rates. Do they have a point?
I think that's a correlation versus causation question. It doesn't surprise me in a way because when inflation is high, interest rates tend to be rising. So people tend to think. And the other reason I think is because people who have mortgages at least, they see increases in interest rates as an increase in the cost of living. But it's not really. So interest rates are the response to high inflation. They're not causing high inflation. I think what it demonstrates is that we need to be doing a better job of getting out there and trying to explain to people in simple terms what's going on and how monetary policy, by raising interest rates, impacts the economy. And we have been trying to do that, and at least part of the purpose of that survey was to try and get an idea of the sorts of issues that we need to be educating people more on and the demographics of the people we need to be educating. Who are the people that would like more information and we're not managing to deliver it to them? So, I understand that that is a perception, but we've got to do better at explaining to people why higher interest rates are not causing inflation. In fact, it's the other way around.
Thanks, Governor.
Damien Bowie, Wilson Asset Management. Just a question, Michelle, about you mentioned before commodity price volatility as something which is clouding the outlook, but a lot of that was kind of tied to war. My question, I guess, is about AI, how that's relating to commodity price volatility and how central bankers are thinking about that. Because you do have the Fed Warsh very focused on AI capex is pretty much the lion's share of what's happening in the US. It seems to me that there is some sensitivity, obviously, of rates there to what's happening with copper and memory and things like that. How does the RBA think about this, given that data centres, while growing, are actually still a very small share of GDP?
Certainly in terms of Australia and the impact of data centre investment and build-out in Australia, what it does to aggregate demand and inflation, because most of the inputs are imported, it doesn't really add as it's not sort of a big push on resources in this economy as it might be. I mean, there is a lot of chip inflation, a lot of expense going into this, and you know, the, interestingly, when I talk to colleagues overseas, and in particular Korean colleagues, they'll make the point that all the bad impacts of the Middle East conflict are completely swamped by the chip story for South Korea. South Korea is booming.
Yes.
But in terms of aggregate demand, it's not really, because it's basically imported. Where we might see it showing up is in construction, to the extent that there's contention of some resources, some trades, and so on. It might show up in inflation there, so we're watching that. More broadly, in terms of your question about Kevin and what might happen over the medium term with AI, I think it's all very uncertain. I think it's possible that, you know, investment will increase pressure in various economies, not just this one. Ultimately, will there be productivity improvements? Possibly, but they might be further out. So how these things sort of interact and the timing of it, I think, remains very uncertain.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay, two last questions, one there and one there. Please make them super quick because we're getting close to the closing remarks.
Thanks, Governor, for taking our questions. Luca Edimani from The Guardian. Just picking up on that, so data centres obviously playing a big role in investment in Australia at the moment, but if you exclude data centres, how does the RBA see business investment in Australia at the moment? How's it responding to rates? What do you see going forward?
So business investment is, a lot of the business investment is in data centres. There's a little bit in renewables as well, but I think probably we would like to see more business investment. We don't think it's... And partly, it's not so much rates. I don't think we feel that interest rates necessarily are the prime determinant of investment, but it's more about businesses' expectations of what they see for the future demand. So are they seeing demand for their services or goods that they can invest and deliver into the future, if you like? So... I think we still do need more investment, and it's clear we need more investment because productivity is not really growing. And what we really need to do is see businesses leaning into investment to increase the amount of capital, perhaps, that they're offering their labour so that labour will become more productive, and looking at ways to better improve the efficiency of the labour-capital combination for production. So it's outside those couple of areas, I'd say business investment isn't shooting the lights out, and that's why I personally think getting inflation down and low and stable is critical, because businesses do better in environments where they're not worrying about cost pressures all the time.
And last question.
Okay, thank you, Bessa, for the time. Thank you, Governor, for the speech. Adam Donaldson from CBA. I'd love to ask about the long-term inflation expectations and whether you're as sceptical of that as I am. But you said a moment ago that the decision the board will have to make is about whether conditions are tight enough to bring inflation back down to target. What I'm wondering is whether the budget and some of the implications for credit growth, et cetera, that flow from that change your assessment of financial conditions and in that way have a bearing on your thinking?
So I think the answer is yes, we are watching that, and the housing market is a bit of a litmus test in some sense. We are seeing commitments come off. We are fully expecting that credit is going to follow. And that is all part of, you know, we talk about the cash rate, but there's a whole lot of things we consider in terms of whether financial conditions are tight or accommodative. There doesn't seem to be any sign that the banks themselves are holding back on credit. So it doesn't seem to be a supply thing. It seems to be more a demand thing. And I think a lot of it's going to depend, certainly in the housing market, on how soon people get their confidence back. There's obviously a lot going on, and I expect that things will settle down. People will get used to the new rules. They'll hopefully the conflict overseas will die down, and they'll get a bit more confidence. Prices might lower a bit, and people might feel more confident to come back into the market. So it is something we're watching. But at the moment, I'd say we think we are on the restrictive side a bit. Maybe not dramatically, but we are on the restrictive side. But the credit thing, I think we do need to just be a little bit careful to watch how things pan out after all these other bits and pieces die down.
Thank you.
Thank you for all those questions and keeping them succinct. And thank you, Michelle. I think you did. You're extremely generous with taking all of those questions. So thank you. I'm going to call the last speaker to the stage.